at checkpoints and nearly has to accuse them of carrying a knife. And so they're also acting as judge, jury, and executioner on a daily basis and using lethal force to kill Palestinians they deem as a threat, even if they don't pose a legal threat. So somebody can be incapacitated on the ground and an Israeli soldier will shoot the Palestinian in their head. And this now, I don't think any of the structure should be evaluated in law, and that's another discussion. But insofar as we're committed to legal frameworks, that execution under occupation law is absolutely prohibited.
Yes, and I have to interrupt because we're out of time, and I want to make sure, if you want to hear more from Noda Erekat, you can do that. We're out of time, but she will be, for those of you in the Bay Area, she will be at the First Congregational Church of Oakland. That's at 2501 Harrison Street in Oakland. You can check out meccaforpeace.org. You can call them up at 548-0542 in the 510 area code. I am delighted that you're doing this work, Noda. It's incredible, very important, and we're going to follow it very closely. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for listening to The Boo, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Running a bit behind, but a minute now after 11 o'clock. And coming up, we've got Between the Covers. Today, host David Naiman will be talking to author Tahimba Jess. Hey, thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet Tahimba Jess. Jess's first book of poetry, Lead Belly, was a winner of the 2004 National Poetry Series. Library Journal and Black Issues Book Review both named it one of the best poetry books of 2005. Jess is a Cave Canem alumnus and earned his MFA at New York University. And his honors include a Whiting Award, a Chicago Sun-Times Poetry Award, a Gwendolyn Brooks Open Mic Poetry Award, a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship, and a Lannan Writing Residency. Jess has taught at Juilliard, at the University of Illinois, and at the College of Staten Island, and his writing has been anthologized in Angles of Ascent, a Norton anthology of contemporary African-American poetry, and Roll Call, a generational anthology of social and political Black literature and art, among many others. Tahimba Jess is here today to talk about his second collection, Olio, 8 years in the Making and Out from Wave Books. The Boston Globe calls Olio one of the most inventive, intensive, poetic undertakings of the past decade. Library Journal calls Olio a formally risky collection that proves to be a character-rich, historically informed page-turner. Olio has been called operatic, an extended performance, an epic libretto, both a celebration of the works and lives of African-American musicians before the Harlem Renaissance, and a subversive account of how Black musicians have been exploited by whites from the get-go. Poet Nikki Finney perhaps says it best of all. this 21st century hymnal of Black evolutionary poetry, this almanac, this theatrical melange of miraculous meta-memory, Tayemba Jess is inventive, prophetic, wondrous. He writes unflinchingly into the historical clefts of blackface, black sound, human sensibility. After the last poem is read, we have no idea how long we've been on our knees. Welcome to Between the Covers, Tayemba Jess.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, let's start with what an oleo is. Right. So what is an oleo?
Well, oleo, O-L-I-O, is a mix, a melange of ingredients that make up a kind of a meal, a stew, so to speak, in the traditional sense. And in the tradition of American theater, it is the middle part of the minstrel show, where there was a variety of acts. So it could be a singer, a dancer, a juggler, a comedian, a contortionist, etc., all together into this one act. And that continued throughout the 19th century. In the 20th century, the oleo evolved into vaudeville, so to speak. So that's what the oleo is in the context of this book.
And for our listeners who don't know, what is a minstrel show?
Right. A minstrel show was a fundamental element of American entertainment throughout the 19th and early 20th century. And it involved mostly white actors putting on blackface to make caricatures of black people and make comedic sketches of black folks. It also evolved to the point where there were black comedians that put on blackface, and it was connected with the image of the of Sambos, Coons, etc. So it's a very difficult area of American history to traverse. It's fraught with a lot of really ugly imagery and a lot of ugly ideology.
Well, at the beginning of the oleo, the oleo that you create, you start by introducing the cast of mm-hmm. the musicians and performers that you've assembled for the people you want to portray and also reclaim. And I was curious about the process you went through to choose who was going to be included. What were the criteria that would allow someone to be possibly considered? And then how did you go about figuring out who was going to be there?
You know, that was what happened is essentially the book took seven to eight years, more or less, to write. And that involved a lot of reading about 19th century events and figures. And there were some people I was interested in. I wanted to get them in the book. I couldn't get them in. And there were others that made it. But it depended to a certain degree on the complexity of the form that I was trying to use to approach the people that appear in the book, and to another extent, who I thought I would be able to capture the best, given the forms that I knew that I could grasp within the pages of the manuscript. So there was, it was more or less kind of going into the 19th century and kind of walking through all of these people, and some of them connected, some of them not, and trying to figure out which ones were going I would be able to lend the best voices to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also this period between the Civil War and World War I straddles mm-hmm. Pre-recording, time yes. before recordings, and yes. then recorded music, mm-hmm. and also slavery and emancipation sort of straddles this time period.
Yes.
Also, so it's an interesting choice that you make.
Yeah, I was also interested in people that had never been recorded. There's only one person in the book of whom there are any recordings, and that would be Burt Williams. But there I was interested in the legacy of Black music before the dawn of commercial recording, of widespread commercial recording. And the question was, what were the Black musicians doing before, you know, really basically 1912, 13, 14, around there, and what were Black creatives trying to manifest right after the Civil War, when you had a newly freed population that was having a new experience with the ability to create of their own volition, using the instruments that they wanted to use, singing the songs that they wanted to sing, for the people that they wanted to sing to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with the benefits of emancipation. So that was part of my question as well.
Well, I was curious. I imagine that for most white people, reading your book will be their first introduction to a lot of these musicians. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's partially due to erasure out of shame about this time period. I don't know. But would most of these people be well known to people in the African American community, or is that also a forgotten era for African American culture too?
I'll say this. I knew some of the people in the book, but I didn't know, for instance, I didn't know very much about Ammonia Lewis. Ammonia Lewis was by far the most successful African-American artist of the 19th century. She sold $50,000 commissions in the latter half of the 19th century, and she was a world-renowned sculptor. I knew about the Fisk Jubilee Singers, and I knew about spirituals, but I didn't know much about the actual original troupe of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, the first, you know, troupe of intrepid young men and women that, you know, set forth around the world to spread the sound of free Blackness around the world, in Europe and in front of kings and queens and in front of presidents, etc. I didn't really know very much at all about Sissy Rider Jones, who was the first African-American to sing at Carnegie Hall. Or I knew very little about Blind Boone. Fascinating character, blind at the age of 6 months, who had a prodigious career. So a lot of the folks here were kind of a revelation to me. And in reading about their lives, I was constantly surprised and amazed at their resilience, and at the odds that they had to face, and the ways that they found to preserve their integrities despite, you know, very difficult odds. So, you know, I think part of the issue is that. If we were living 100 years ago, we would know who these people are. But given the fact that none of them were recorded, and there are really not very many photographs. I mean, for instance, Henry Box Brown, I don't know that there are any photographs of him. I could be wrong. Had a fascinating career as a kind of lecturer and as a mesmerist in Britain. Huh. And yeah, you know, I had no idea. I knew that he had done the amazing feat of escaping from slavery by putting himself in a 2x3 box and mailing himself from Virginia to Philadelphia, but I didn't know anything about his performing career. And that is the kind of thing that fascinated me about this particular era.
Yeah. We're talking today to poet Tyan Bajess, the author of Olio. You mentioned at the beginning that Olio is the second part of the minstrel show, but it also means hodgepodge or a stew of different ingredients.
Yes.
And that this book definitely fulfills that aspect of it too. It's got fiction, it's got nonfiction, it's got poetry, it's got historical documents, it's got imagined historical documents, it's got illustrations, it's got photography, it's got foldouts, it's got tables, and it's got timelines. It's got a lot in this Olio. And it's pretty common when I have guests on the show that maybe it takes them a long time between books. And the common response is, well, I got stuck on something conceptually or I had writer's block. But it's really clear when you look at this book and when you read this book that it would require this much time to figure out how to put this together. And when people talk about the way that it's both experimental and engaging and easy to go through and formally risky and historical and yet somehow contemporary, I have to say, like, it's a book that I really feel a lot of awe about and a lot of curiosity because of that awe on how in the world do you put this together. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about post Lead Belly, your first book, how this started to come together as a concept. What were the fits and starts, and then some of the challenges?
Wow. Well, after Lead Belly, I was in a pretty dormant state for a little while. I was trying to catch up with a lot of things in my life. And I was kind of stuck in the voices in Lead Belly for quite a while. That book took 5 years to complete, so it took me a little while to switch gears. And writing Olio really started with Blind Tom and writing these sonnets, the Crown of Sonnets in Blind Tom. And writing, for me, using form, sonnets, huzzles, haiku, etc., was a kind of way out of the voice that was trapped in my head, and I was able to break out of the Lead Belly voice and to access a different kind of narrative, so to speak. So. That was the beginning of the flow for Olio, and really I just started trying to push the idea of a contrapuntal book, a book that would use counterpointed poems, and push that to the extreme as far as I could take it, and then. Some of the other folks came into the book, you know, like the Fish Jubilee Singers, Burt Williams and George Walker, and the McCoy twins. And really, though, after it wasn't until about 5.5 years in that the form of the whole book started to become clear, that it was what the layout of the book was going to look like.
Yeah.
And that was actually a sigh of relief. Because at that point, it was probably about 160 pages in, and maybe 180, I don't know. And then it became a matter of trying my best to do due diligence with the rest of the book, you know?
Yeah, well, I'd like to talk more about this idea of the counterpoint poem. There are some things that are similar with Lead Belly. One of them, they're both about, both books are addressing African-American musicians. Also musicians playing under the white gaze and trying to reclaim music and trying to stay authentic in a potentially compromised scenario, I would say in their performances. But the other thing that there's some similarity within the two books is this counterpoint, the two intermeshed voices. You have in Olio, Blind Boone meets Blind Tom, the many McCoy sisters poems, the Burt Williams, George Walker paradox, the Dunbar Booker double shovel. And in Leadbelly, you have the Leadbelly Al Lomax poems.
Right.
I know there's some similarities and then there's some big departures. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the ways in which those two are related and different from each other?
Yeah. Well, in Leadbelly, there is no use of form, so to speak, in the contrapuntal poems. And in Olio, the primary difference is that there is a lot of use of form with the contrapuntal poems. So you have syncopated sonnets, you have paradoxahuzzles, you have the double shovel, as you mentioned. And so really the idea was to take that concept from Leadbelly and to bring it into the strictures of form, but also to bend form so that form could do something different than it was previously doing. And also it was the idea of double consciousness that was expressed by W.B. Du Bois within Souls of Black Folks. He's talking about, you know, the idea of working with two different mindsets in order to function completely throughout one's everyday life as an African American. And I guess I would say the contrapuntals in Olio were more, like I said, directed towards that idea of taking the contrapuntal and stretching it as far as I possibly could, and as far as I know it has been stretched. So that is one of the critical differences. Like the idea of the double consciousness is more pronounced. The idea of to let the reader make their own decisions as to how they are going to take themselves through the poem started to make itself known throughout the construction of the book, and the idea that the reader can, and the subject of the poem can take a two-dimensional surface and make it a three-dimensional object became kind of a minor motif in the poem, in the manuscript. So all of those things started to run together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe a good example is to talk about the conjoined twins, the right. McCoy sisters, mm-hmm. because essentially you create these conjoined poems that right. you can read down either side as if you're reading just the voice of one of the sisters, or you can read across and it still makes sense as if you're reading a shared voice right. of the two sisters, kind of like their shared circulatory system.
Right.
That was amazing to behold as a reader, but it was even more amazing to see you perform, because there were all levels of complexity I didn't realize until I saw you read them, that you could actually read the poems from the bottom up
right.
diagonally. And you even have a page where you can put all of the McCoy sisters' poems together and form a super body.
Yes.
And then read across poems.
Star of syncopated sonnets.
Okay. And the meaning is coheres no matter what choice you make mm-hmm. with this. Can you both talk about the McCoy sisters mm-hmm. and then maybe shed a little bit of light on what feels... I don't want to call it a magic trick, because it's clearly art, but there is a magical element to yeah. what you've done. And how did you stumble upon this ability?
Well, first, the McCoy twins were Pygopagus twins, born into slavery in the Carolinas in 1849. They were, if you could imagine, two women standing back to back, but they are joined through basically the bottom of the rib cage all the way through the pelvis, with two separate set of arms, separate heads, legs, etc., just explicitly joined through the spine and into the in through the pelvis. And the poems that were made to talk about their lives makes an effort to assume a kind of concrete form of poetry. Concrete just means that the poem looks like the object that it is talking about. Okay, so in constructing those poems, really, I was led to the construction of those poems through, to back up for a second, through the poems in the Blind Tom section. Because if you look at the poems in the there's a lot of poems about another performer who was autistic and blind, named Blind Tom, who was also born around 1849, who was owned by the same family basically until he died in the early 1900s. But in those poems, I started to make contrapuntal poems that had the kind of flexibility that I later used for the McCoy twins. Hmm. And so I don't know how much of this your audience is getting, because just have to go buy the book.
would you read McCoy twin poem?
Sure, I will. But I will read it with the caveat that I will do my best to try to explain to the audience what is happening while I am reading it. And so here we go. Let me see. If you look at the poem, you see an X. The X is composed of lines that go down in three columns. One on the left, one in the middle, one on the right. If you start on the left and read down the first two lines, you read, "We've mended two songs in the one dark skin, bleeding soprano into contralto." If you look on the right, you read these two lines, "We ride the wake of each other's rhythm, beating our heart's syncopated tempo." If you read those lines directly across, they read, "We've mended two songs in the one dark skin. We ride the wake of each other's rhythm, bleeding soprano into contralto, beating our heart's syncopated tempo." And then beneath those lines, you would find two more lines, which would be the shared lines of each of the twins. They would say together, "We're fused in blood and body from one thrum stem, budding twin blooms of song. We're a doubled rose." So in that way, that's just a small taste of the conjoining of two voices into one.
Yeah.
It's and hard to explain over the radio.
And so there's an innumerable number of ways you could read this out loud.
Yes.
Would you read the poem one way for us?
What I'll do is I'll take those last lines that I read,
yeah,
and I'll read them in reverse. So this is from the bottom going up.
Okay.
"Budding twin blooms of song, we're a double rose. We're fused in blood and body from one thrum stem, bleeding soprano into contralto, beating our heart's syncopated tempo. We've mended two songs in the one dark skin. We ride the wake of each other's rhythm." So those are the exact same lines that I read, but read backwards, so to speak. And so the reader has the choice to read down and up, and also really basically diagonally when you explore the poem fully.
And all of this sounds super daunting if you're not looking at the right poem right now, but it is actually really engaging and accessible at the same time, which is kind
I'm
of
glad
the,
to hear that.
It's the miracle of it, I think, is that you've done that. You've said that the oleo that oleo has a circular motif, and
yes,
that the number 7 is also important in the book. And
yes,
I was curious about both of those things. Does the circularity have to do with this idea of being able to read from bottom to
it
top
does.
Or top to
it
bottom.
It does have to do with the idea of being able to read from top to bottom and bottom to top. It also has to do with the idea that there are some poems that you can literally tear off the book because they are perforated pages. And you can manipulate the page into cylinders, into essentially into a torus, T-O-R-U-S, which is basically a donut, or into a Mobius strip. So that's kind of another demonstration of circularity. The other circularity lies in a double crown of sonnets in the book that goes from the beginning all the way through the entire book, and is about the Fitzjubilee Singers. And so in a crown of sonnets, the very first line of the first poem becomes the very last line and so on and so on until the last line of the last poem becomes the first line of the first poem. So it forms a circle, like a crown. And so that is another aspect of circularity. Another aspect is the fact that you're dealing with history, and history tends to repeat itself. And that is more, I couldn't be more more poetically and tragically displayed than the list of burned churches in the book that starts from 1822 and goes up to 2015. But at the very first church is the very last church that's listed in that particular list. So it was really met a certain kind of devastation twice historically. So there's a lot of circles going on in the book. And sevens, there's essentially seven distinct sections. And there's a lot of sevens in it because the idea of a crown of sonnets got stuck in my head. And Crown of Sonnets usually has seven poems in it. And so really, it kind of started with the very first sequence, which is Blind Tom. And it kind of bloomed from there.
Does the seven nod towards the Sabbath and the Jubilee year in the Bible?
That's a good one. That's a good one, too. Yes. As a matter of fact, that's really interesting you would say that because... The book was finished in 2015, which would be the third Jubilee after 1865.
Mm.
So
wow.
Jubilee is essentially 50 years, 49 to 50 years. You know? So, you know, the Jubilee is biblical. After seven sevens, there is a period of forgiveness and forgiveness of debts, of letting slaves free, etc. And that is why the Fisk singers are called Jubilee singers, because they were singers of freedom, of Jubilee. And the book was finished in 2015. I was 50 years old. I'm still, you know, there were a lot of things that kind of wrapped up together.
Yeah.
And, you know, made it a kind of special moment for me, and I guess that translated into the book.
We're talking today to poet Tayan Bajess, the author of Olio. Well, speaking of the macro and the micro aspect of the book, one of the ways the book I think is really interesting is that you introduce a cast of characters. You've curated the show in a sense, in one regard, the MC of this
the interlocutor
of the Olio, right?
Yeah.
So there's always this sense of this cohesive superstructure for the book, but there's also a way in which each performer's individual history, each figure has its own distinct form in this, and then sort of claims their own sort of entire universe. So you mentioned the burned churches. So every time the Jubilee singers sing, we get more of the lists of the churches that have been burned.
Yes.
When the McCoy sisters appear, we get the syncopated sonnets. And then often when we're engaging with Scott Joplin, we're in the interview format. It kind of echoes the sense of the way each of these artists are trying to bend form.
Mm-hmm.
To preserve or to assert authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this quote from Blind Boone, tell the story straight and true so that the joke's not on you, but all around you. And I was hoping you could maybe speak to that quote in light of the ways different musicians employ strategies to find or to assert their authenticity in an art form that's sort of inherently compromised, because it's an art form that doesn't recognize or happens at the expense of their humanity in the purpose of it existing in the first place.
Talk about minstrelsy.
The minstrel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that when Blind Boone is saying that to his interviewer, he's talking about preserving your own integrity in the face of very tricky and shifting odds. Telling the story in such a way that you keep sight of your own positionality, telling the story in such a way that you remind yourself that you're in the middle of a story and that you kind of have the opportunity to shape your story, so to speak. I think that's what he's talking about there, and I think that he's being interviewed by somebody who's really intrigued about the life and demise of Scott Joplin. And he's also giving a kind of a warning to that person about the things that they're looking for and what they expect and what they might find. And I think there's a multitude of decisions that African-American artists, African-American people have to make on a regular day-to-day, hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute basis to deal with the kind of microaggressions or downright straight up aggression and the kind of difficult moments and awkward moments that we have to deal with that make us decide for ourselves how we're going to deal with those issues in order to avoid the specter of the minstrel show, in order to avoid becoming the minstrel, in order to avoid becoming played, so to speak,
right,
and made two-dimensional instead of realizing our own three-dimensional realness. And I think that's a constant in every field of endeavor in when you're dealing with a white supremacist society, when you're dealing with all of the kind of echoes of history that come from the minstrel milieu in which these characters had to deal with every day, you know?
And of course, each of the people in Olio are going to have really different strategies to either avoid the minstrel show or try to subvert it. Some of them are going to Europe.
Yeah.
Some of them call them their own act, Two Real Coons,
right,
sort of taking the name and then distorting it and delivering it back.
Yeah, that's very interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's hard reading about all of that history and seeing the way that folks were trying to preserve their integrity and were trying to preserve their freedom, you know, and their lives in many occasions, was a real lesson for me about the ways that those same strategies are being employed today, you know. So, yeah, Burt Williams and George Walker called their act Two Real Coons. They did that in an effort to really to drum up business for themselves and really kind of slip a weird inside joke on the minstrel industry, so to speak. So instead of seeing white folks dress up in blackface, why not see two real black folks dress up in blackface? Why not, instead of seeing white folks try to act black, why not see black folks being black? You know what I'm saying? But at the same time, you know, I think they were able to produce some of the first independent black theater productions. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, therein lies the paradox that they were forced to deal with on a regular basis.
And that paradox of, like, being exploited and also asserting authenticity at the same time, potentially. Mm-hmm. I feel like you did this great job in your choice of illustrator. Like, I think of the, particularly there's one image that I love of a piano player, and his body is all contorted so that he's facing away from the piano while he's playing it.
Right.
There's this sense of ambivalence and tension and conflict in the actual act of making the music. Can you talk about what the illustrations are doing?
Jessica Lynn Brown out of Missouri is a fascinating artist that I discovered via the internet, who, like that particular illustration you're talking about, that's Blind Tom. Yeah, a scene from one of the poems where this is one of the things that he would do, is he would play the piano behind his back. Yeah. So, I think I was really lucky to run across her, because I think the sparseness and the energy of her very raw but very sophisticated drawings gives the reader a kind of space to release from all of the words and all of the imagery in the words, and try to kind of, you know, it gives the reader a little bit of space,
yeah,
to absorb everything that's happening in the book. And that was a real stroke of luck to come across Jessica Lynn Brown.
And just a weird aside, I read that she can simultaneously write with both hands in opposite directions.
Yes, she
which
can.
Which reminds me of your poems.
Exactly. And that's the reason why when I saw that, she can take dictation, more or less. You just say a line to her, she'll write with both hands going in opposite directions.
Wow.
And it's almost, when you see it happen, it's really strange. You kind of have to rub your eyes and ask yourself if you're seeing it. But that's what she does. And when I saw that, I was like, okay, I found a contrapuntal artist.
Yeah.
And I have to engage her in some kind of way and make something happen in this project. So, you know, I'd seen her work and blah, and I kind of hemmed and hawed on it for a little while, because, you know, the book wasn't done, blah, blah, blah. And then, like in the last year, I think, 14 or so, I was like, yeah, you know, can you, we talk about some drawings, et cetera, and we got it together. So
yeah.
I'm really, really pleased, because I think that she really does add another dimension to the book.
I think so too.
Yeah.
You mentioned that image is Blind Tom. Would you be willing to read what marked Tom?
Yes, I'd love to. What marked Tom? Did a slave song at a master's bidding mark Tom while asleep in Charity's womb? The whole plantation would be called to sing and dance in Master Epps' large parlor room. After work sprung from dawn and dragged past dusk. After children auctioned to parts unknown. After funerals and whippings. Thus was the whim of the patriarch. No groans allowed, just high step in celebration. Grins all around, gritted or sincere. Charity threw feet, hips, arms into motion to please the tyrant piano. Was it here Tom learned how music can prove the master, while he spun in a womb of slavish laughter?
You've been listening to Tayan Bajess read from his latest book of poetry, Olio. Well, to pivot to like a totally different tone in Olio, perhaps my favorite section of the book is the Freed Songs, which is your twinning of Henry Box Brown and John Berryman to blacken the voice of the character Henry in John Berryman's Dream Songs. So, and as you say, to liberate Henry from literary bondage. Can you talk about that project, how it came to be, and in what ways the Freed Songs and the Dream Songs mirror or diverge from each other as poems?
Well, I call that the inside joke of the book. Inside joke because it's not that John Berryman is an obscure literary figure, but most of the people that know about him will be poets. John Berryman won the Pulitzer Prize for the Dream Songs in 1965. And he uses the voice of an imaginary, kind of imaginary minstrel voice in order to voice his own anxieties of being white, male, you know, middle age, and dealing with the various issues that he has to encounter in his life. And now it's pretty much impossible to go through an MFA in the United States without hearing John Berryman's name or having read at least one of his poems, such as what happened to me when I went through my MFA, actually with one of his proteges, Philip Levine. And so upon receiving these poems and upon understanding the fact that they were in this kind of minstrelized voice, I really did not know how to process my, I guess disappointment or my inability to be fully moved by his invocation of this black imaginary voice in his poems. And so with that question mark forever being lit over my head regarding John Berryman, you know, I walked around with that question mark in my head for many, many years. And I sought out as much critique as I could about his racialization of his voice in the Berryman poems, and I have not really found a whole heck of a lot. So that was part one. Part two is I was really interested in Henry Box Brown, as I said, who had escaped from slavery by putting himself in a box and mailing himself to freedom, and then was almost dragged back into slavery when he was assaulted on the streets of Philadelphia. And pretty much the very next week or so, he was on a boat to England, where he became a performer, a very astute performer, and continued that performance career for roughly 20-odd years, and became a mesmerist after the Civil War. Fascinating. And so, but I was thinking, how do I tell his story? And there was all kinds of schemes I was developing that had to do with, you know, trying to make a three-dimensional poem, etc., blah, blah, blah. But none of it was really working. But, suddenly one day one of those two ideas connected together. And the name that Berryman uses for his persona in the Dream Songs is Henry. And all of a sudden, I kind of toyed with the idea, and then it started to come out. I took the sound, the exact sound of every one of these, I guess I used about, 13 poems or so. And I took the exact sound, you know, the vowel sounds of all these poems, and I structured a narrative for Henry Box Brown, following the line breaks, following the stanza breaks. So instead of, it's almost like a, it's trying to be like a riddle in a riddle in a riddle.
Yeah.
You know, or a voice in a voice in a voice, or a mask in a mask in a mask, or who, and the question comes, who is wearing the mask? Because Berryman's voice is being incorporated to tell Henry Box Brown's voice, whereas Berryman's had originally meant to co-opt or use this kind of black minstrelized voice to talk about his own pain. Now we have an opportunity for somebody who was in the middle of the height of the minstrel show and trying to get himself free and exercising his freedom to freedom that he had to, you know, scheme for in order to create new a kind of new vistas of expression when he went to England. All right, we have him using Berryman's voice. So
would you be willing to read a preface or preface?
Yes, yeah, I would. Yeah. For your readers, what I'll explain that on one side of the poem, I'm going to read three things. I'll read John Berryman's side of the poem. Then I will read Henry Box Brown's side of the poem. And then I will read the two sections together. Okay. So this quote is directly from the preface of the Dream Songs. So there's no, it's verbatim from the preface. The poem, then, whatever its wide cast of characters, is essentially about an imaginary character, not the poet, not me, named Henry, a white American in early middle age, sometimes in blackface, who has suffered an irreversible loss and talks about himself. That is Berryman's quote. On the other hand, we have Henry Box Brown's quote. It's imaginary, of course. Let me say, despite loss, I won my life. This story, how a slave steals back his skin, smuggles loose like I did. It lives on, but through words and free. I'm Box Brown. Ain't masking my truth. One day, I delivered myself. I ache my love for those left behind. Berryman can't talk for them. Can't tell my tale at all. So those two quotes are situated on either side of each other with a caesura going down the middle. And when read together, they read, the poem then, let me say, whatever its wide cast of characters, despite loss, I won my life. This story is essentially about how a slave steals back his skin. An imaginary character smuggles loose like I did. It lives on, not the poet, but through words and not me. Free. I'm named Henry Box Brown. Ain't a white American masking my truth. One day in early middle age, I delivered myself. Sometimes I ache in my blackface love for who has suffered, those left behind. An irreversible loss. Berryman can't talk for them and talks about himself. Can't tell my tale at all.
We're talking today to poet Tyan Bajess, the author of Olio. you do some other unmasking of beloved characters. I think of Irving Berlin and Mark Twain, who you show in their own words some of the
biases.
Yeah, the biases and ignoble actions that they do. Can you talk a little bit about how they play minor roles in Olio?
Mark Twain was a big fan of Blind Tom's, and he would write, you know, he would do music critiques, etc. And he wrote a kind of critique of Blind Tom that, how should I say it? I kind of have a high regard for Mark Twain. I love who he was and the way that he, the contributions he made. But I think it was important in the context of Blind Tom for Blind Tom to have a voice against or in response to Mark Twain's characterization of Blind Tom's consciousness. And so just like what happened with the Berryman Brown poem, I did something similar where you have Mark Twain's quote on one side and on the other side, there's Blind Boone's response to it, which gives Blind Boone the last word in the equation,
mm-hmm.
and gives us a different understanding of perhaps what was going through Blind Tom's mind. You know, we don't have any real clear idea what his consciousness was, what he was thinking, but I think that he did know. He had this understanding of himself and his music that was not given due credit in Mark Twain's rendition of him, you know? And with Irving Berlin, well, basically, there was a real dispute between him and Scott Joplin about one of his tunes, one of Scott Joplin's tunes that was fundamental to his last opera called Treemonisha. And it was such a difficult dispute that at one point Irving Berlin took out an ad in a paper pretty much declaring that he was the sole author of this very popular tune that was hot on the charts called Alexander's Ragtime Band. You may have heard of it. And so the contention is that what I really bring to light is the contention between him and Scott Joplin and Scott's claim to that tune, so to speak. It's about, you know, character, and it's about ownership.
Yeah.
And mastery to a certain degree. And I will say one other thing is that in that poem, that Berryman Brown poem, I did my best to make them syllabically symmetrical. So that the Berryman Brown is syllabically symmetrical, and the Irving Berlin is syllabically symmetrical. So in other words, Berryman has just as many syllables on every line as Henry Box Brown does, and Irving Berlin has just as many syllables on every line as Scott Joplin does.
Wow.
So there you go.
Yeah, well, would you, if you don't mind, I'd love to finish with one last poem.
And sure.
I was thinking Minnehaha, the poem about one of the sculptures of Edmonia Lewis.
Oh, yeah, Minnehaha. Yeah, okay. Let me see. These poems are written in the voices of sculptures of Edmonia Lewis.
So the sculpture itself is the voice of the
poem. Right. And this is a real sculpture of hers, Minnehaha. You know, Edmonia Lewis, was Native American and Black, and she was part Chippewa, I think, and her father was a Maroon, escaped slave. Fascinating history behind her, but she became one of the most, you know, influential sculptures of her time. So, this is Minnehaha, Edmonia Lewis, marble, 1868. What part of me is mine that was not mined from the mind of poets, artists, rewriting the past blow by blow till it's pulverized past the barely recognizable? I was born when I was written, then hammered out of a mountain. I was shattered and then broken, then sharpened to the human. I'm carved in marble that never dies, hardly crumbles. A stubborn queen who'll die only with those people who crave a ruling monarchy of fictions. Tales my sculptor plied to strike against their pale armies of indignities. History is their favorite lie. I found my face buried in its would-be pages, then excavated by a native who fled the country. Such was her misery at home in the land where my legend roams, the canonized American poetry. I'm her stone arrow, her refusal to bow. I wear her chisel-sharp aim as my crown.
You've been listening to Tayemba Jess read from Olio. It was a deep pleasure to have you on Between the Covers today.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for bringing me out. Yeah. Portland rocks.
We were talking today with Tayemba Jess, the author of Olio from Wave Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Be sure that you're tuned in to KBOO Community Radio just before midnight on Thursday, November 17th for a very special celebration of Hip Hop History Month. We'll be dropping a 3-hour block of old school beats from back in the day. Again, tune in just before midnight on Thursday, November 17th. For our celebration of Hip Hop History Month, right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.